This morning, I also want to continue in a study that I think is very important for us. Let's begin with a prayer. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, asher kidshenu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu la'asok b'divrei Torah. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who sanctifies us with his commands and commands us to engross ourselves in the words of Torah. Amen. As we're reading from the book of Exodus, the second book of Torah, Shemot, we are recalling for ourselves, or learning, in the case of some of us, for the first time, how the children of Israel came down to Egypt, and then how there was slavery and how God delivered the children of Israel, and then the journey out of Egypt and the journey towards the promised land. It's an incredible story, and it's one that we need to remind ourselves of because it helps us understand who we are. We also read in the first chapter of Exodus that there arose a new Pharaoh. This is in verse 8. Exodus 1, verse 8. There arose a new Pharaoh, a new king over Egypt, and he did not know Joseph. He didn't recall what Joseph had done for the Egyptian people. He did not realize, or he ignored the fact that God had used Joseph to save Egypt in the famine. Had it not been for Joseph, Egypt as a nation would have starved and been destroyed. Had it not been for Joseph, the Egyptian people, even the kingdom of Egypt, would have been eliminated. And so it was through Joseph that God showed mercy to Egypt. The Pharaoh did not understand that. He did not recognize it. He had a hostile attitude about the Jewish people who were living in his land. He saw them as a threat. And when the Jewish people were prospering, he thought that's even more dangerous. He used the language of bugs and insects to describe the condition of the Jewish people. He said they're swarming. It's like the land's teeming. It would be as if we were saying something about the cockroaches in Florida. That's how he was describing the Jewish people. And he saw the Jewish people as a dangerous threat. He forgot that God had used the Jewish people to save Egypt in the most practical and real ways. Because of his wrong attitude and his wrong understanding, he did not relate well to Jews. And later on, as if you read this Torah portion, you'll see that God pulled a fast one, you know, on the future pharaohs because he brought a Jew into the house of Pharaoh. It's a good warning, you know, for all the anti-Semites who claim to believe in the Messiah. You know, there's a warning. One day you're going to end up in a Jewish house. Get ready. The Pharaoh actually wanted the Jewish people destroyed. And so he ordered the murder of the young, the newborn males among the Jewish people. And yet there was one who is most famous. His name is Moses, Moshe in Hebrew. And he is the one we want to look at in particular this morning and connect his experience with our own experience. So I want to give you a short summary from the Torah portion this morning. Moses was born to a Jewish family in Egypt, but he was raised as an Egyptian in the house of Pharaoh. And you can read this. It's very plain. It's very simple. It's easy to understand just reading through the Torah portion. That's why I encourage you, don't wait until after the service to read the Torah portion. Come having read the portion, the Haftorah and the Brit Hadashah reading, so that you will be better prepared. And you know the story, how Moses, you know, when he was born, he was a beautiful baby, and he was eventually put in a basket and on the river, and the daughter of Pharaoh discovered him and brought him into her house. And so this little Jewish baby is brought into the house of Pharaoh, where he grows up as an Egyptian. So Moses spent 40 years away from his Jewish family and living with an Egyptian family. And then after that, you remember there was a moment when Moses saw a taskmaster violently mistreating one of the children of Israel, one of the workers who was enslaved, and he tried to rescue him. It turned out badly. Moses ended up killing the taskmaster, and then he felt he had to escape himself, so he fled. And he went away. He ended up in Midian, and there he married a Midianite woman who was the daughter of Jethro. His name was Yitro. Say that with me, Yitro. And Yitro was a Midianite who was a priest of the Lord. So Yitro had some kind of knowledge and some kind of relationship, some kind of ministry to the Lord. It wasn't complete, but it was a place where Abraham was exposed to this form of religion, if you will. So think about it. Moses grew up in an Egyptian household, and the Egyptians thought that Pharaoh was God incarnate, the incarnation of the sun god Ra. They had many gods, and then he ends up in Midian, where there's a priest of God, but this priest doesn't know all the particulars. And you know, you don't always get things right when you don't know the particulars. One of the things that Yitro wasn't fully aware of was the importance of God's identification of himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Israel. And so that became a defining issue later on. So Moses is in Midian. He spends 40 years there, and he's working as a shepherd. He's no longer a prince of Egypt. He's now just a shepherd. And as he's taking care of sheep one day, there's this well-known experience. God appears to him in the burning bush. And purely out of curiosity, Moses approaches, and there God reveals himself. It's an awesome moment. And through this moment, God reveals himself as the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And God calls Moses to return to Egypt and to lead his people out. Now, he's an escaped fugitive. He's a fugitive from justice in his own mind. And can you imagine how awkward it would be? God comes and he knows this is Moses, and he says, "Moses, Moses." I could imagine that Moses might have preferred to think he was hallucinating. Burning bush, I'm hearing my name, back to the sheep. This is what happens when you work by yourself in the desert for too long. But in fact, it was the Lord. And the Lord said, go back. Now he's 80 years old and he's got this new assignment to go back to Egypt and to tell Pharaoh to let the people go. Pharaoh, lover of the Jews. Yeah. So now he has this assignment to lead the Jewish people out of Egypt, out of slavery, and into a new life in service to the God of Israel. So think about this. Moses was born in a Jewish family, but he was raised in the household of the Egyptian Pharaoh. And so he learned Egyptian. He dressed like an Egyptian. He studied the things of Egypt. He was immersed in the culture and the religion, exposed to that religion. And then he ends up in Midianite, another version in Midian. And then he gets called back to Egypt. What a crazy mixed up history. And some of you can fully identify with this. And you can say, you know, that sounds like me. I was here and then I was there and I was with this and that. And these people talked about God this way and that way. And I don't know who I am. So we will learn something by looking at the journey of Moses and looking at the journey of the children of Israel. Through this crazy history, Moses has to realize who he is, who were his people, and who was his God. And he had to make a choice about his Jewish identity, a choice about the Jewish people being his people, and a choice about the God of Israel being his God, not some undefined God, and not one of many gods, and not another alternative view of God. Well, this whole thing reworked and reshaped Moses' past so that he could look back and see what God had been doing. It helped him understand his present so that he could see what was happening right now. And it made sense as well of his future, because now he could see, this is what I'm choosing to do. Now, as I was reading this, I thought, it's very different from my experience, because I grew up in a Jewish family where none of this was hidden. I grew up in a family in some ways that was like Moses, though, because it says in chapter 2 of Exodus, verse 1, that a man of the house of Levi had a wife who was also a daughter of Levi. So Levites on both sides. And so I thought, well, I can relate to Moses that way because I am from the tribe of Levi on both sides. And I thought, okay, so now I can relate to him. I have no experience in Egypt, though I know a Messianic Jew from Egypt. But that's about the limit of my knowledge. But I was thinking about my own experience. I came from a Jewish family, Levites. That's how we get the name Levine. It's not because I like to wear Levi jeans. And my grandparents, most of them came from what is now Russia or Ukraine now. Before, some of those territories were German. They were Austro-Hungarian. There's an old joke about the Jewish mother in one of these cities, grandmother, elderly, and her grandson runs in and he's talking about the latest battle and says, "We don't live in Ukraine anymore. Now we live in the Austro-Hungarian Empire." And she says, "Baruch Hashem, I hated those Ukrainian winters." My grandparents on my mother's side ended up moving to Israel. After having lived in the United States, they became citizens of Israel. Sandy and I didn't move to Israel. We thought we were going to, but we also have our citizenship in Israel. And so when I think about my own history, I think, okay, this is my journey. I was thinking about my dad and two of my sisters who were presidents of conservative Jewish synagogues. My dad was president of the Jewish Federation. And so we grew up as Jews. There was nothing hidden about our Jewishness. I remember when I was young, we went to a school that had Christmas pageants. But my parents talked to the school administration, and we never went to participate in those Christmas pageants. So sometimes I would sit in my classroom all by myself for hours while they were rehearsing for the Christmas pageant. And if the rehearsals were really tedious and boring, the other kids would come back into the classroom, you know, sort of. And they'd look at me, I'm sitting there, you know, I've been there for hours, you know, minding my own business. And they'd say, "You're so lucky that you're Jewish." So everybody knew we were Jews. There was nothing hidden about that. But what did redefine and reshape my life and my Jewishness was Yeshua. When I realized that he was Messiah, it changed my Jewish life. I remember years later, I was having lunch with an Orthodox rabbi. It was set up by a Messianic believer who had experience both in a traditional synagogue and in a Messianic synagogue. He thought the two of us should meet. And so that rabbi said, "I can understand why this guy would, you know, he's a Gentile. What does he know? You know, that he would think Jesus is the Messiah, but you're a Jew. How could you think Jesus is the Messiah?" And I said, "It's worse than you imagine." Because I also think he's Adonai. And we had an incredible conversation. You see, I grew up as a Jew. That just happened to be my experience, Jewish on both sides. And so we have to each know our own experience so we can come to terms with God based on that. I'm a Messianic Jew now. I'm not hiding that from anyone. I am a Jew who follows Messiah Yeshua, and I don't want to be another type of Jew. There's not another version that I'm looking for. Messianic Jew is good for me. Now, I want to give you some background, and I want to talk about some challenging issues, because over the next few weeks, we want to explore, as we're looking at how the children of Israel have to grapple with identity and relationship, and what will be authoritative to them, and what will define them, who they are together, and what they are not. As we're reading the book of Exodus, I want to talk to you about a theme that we could call finding our way. We have to find our way, and I want to introduce something that Yeshua said. It's an important principle that means a lot to me. It's in Luke chapter 6, verse 40. Luke chapter 6, verse 40. Yeshua said, "A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone who's fully trained will be like his teacher." So when I read this, it really helped me understand an important principle. For me to become who I want to be as a Messianic Jew, I have to make sure Yeshua is my teacher. I have to make sure that his rabbinic authority, interpretation, and understanding, his example is the model for me, and not another model, and not another rabbi. We will become like the ones who teach us. That's what Yeshua was saying. And so I want to tell you something. We have to be careful about who we learn from. And be careful not to learn from those who we don't want to become like. Because by exposure, we will become like them. So if you want to be a disciple of Yeshua, be very careful about what you learn from those who reject Yeshua. Very important principle we'll be returning to again and again. The model that you choose, the teacher, the congregation, the community of faith, the sources that you consider to be authoritative and defining for you, the traditions and customs you follow, and the people you fellowship closely with, these will all have an impact on who you are and what you become. And it's important to understand who you are and to make sense of it, and to choose wisely. Now, we are a diverse congregation. Is that correct? You know what that means? There are a lot of people not like you in the congregation. So what unites us needs to be something very clear. It needs to be that we have agreed upon something, that Yeshua is Mashiach and Adonai. It's important for us to be simple about it in order to have depth about that. It's important to understand as well that there are certain texts, religious texts, that are useful for us and others that are dangerous for us because they will lead us away from Yeshua. The teachings of the apostles is this, that the Torah, the Tanakh, will lead us to Messiah. But that doesn't mean every interpretation of Torah or the Tanakh will lead us to Messiah. In fact, Yeshua was concerned in the weeks to come, we'll look at some warnings that Yeshua gave, where he warned his own disciples about some of the controversies, and warned his disciples to not give in to things that he called yeast that would infiltrate and like rise up in them and permeate their very being, because there can be a dangerous portion. So Yeshua also, according to the apostles, sometimes did things that went against some other Jewish traditions. We'll look at those in the future. So when you know that Yeshua is your authoritative rabbi, it helps you understand who's not your authoritative rabbi. And I want to help you on this. I want to give protection to you and some understanding as well. So let me give one example. I was looking at some of the teachings of Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson. How many of you know what city he was born in?
Nikolaev,
that's right. Same place that Rabbi Yuri and Ina Korshin are from. He left Nikolaev, they stayed. He's gone, they're still having an impact. But Rabbi Schneerson became the Rebbe, the leader of a movement called Chabad, also called Lubavitch, and also called Chabad Lubavitch. And if you don't know how to pronounce Lubavitch, you might say Lubavitch. Some do. They don't. And his movement sees him as Messiah. Now, some of them say, no, he's not Messiah, but he could have been. But I was reading some of the material and watching some of the videos he recorded that he left for posterity. And he has a teaching. It's a very subtle and important teaching. He says there are some tzaddikim, some holy ones among the Hasidim, the Hasidic movement, who rise to such a level that they become part of God. And they cease to have their own independent existence. And if you look at them, you'll see God. Can you imagine the point? His point is this: when you look at me, Rabbi Schneerson, you're seeing such a person. And this is very dangerous. Can you see how dangerous that is? Now you might say, well, I like the Chabad, I like the Hanukkah party. I'm not talking about what's the good part versus what's the bad part so that you can weigh it out. I'm talking about what's the dangerous part so that you can be warned about that. Some people say, well, I can separate the good from the bad. And the answer is sometimes you may be able to and sometimes you may not be able to. So it's important to learn how to do it and whether you should even try. There is a proverb that says this: a wise man sees evil and flees, but a foolish man, a naive person, approaches and then pays the penalty. So one of the things that you have to learn is, when do you need to flee? I can tell you, I want to be a Messianic Jew. I don't want to be a Chabadnik. I don't want to be a Breslov, follower of Rebbe Nachman, another figure in the Hasidic movement who is esteemed. You see, each of these Hasidic movements identifies themselves according to which rabbi they look to as the highest authority and the perfect example of Jewish life. Now, here's what I know. You can't pledge allegiance to one of them and to Yeshua at the same time. One of them will be higher than the other. It's important to understand that. So it's important to make your choices wisely and not foolishly. Now, one of the reasons that I'm speaking about this is because in our diversity, we see lots of different interests and lots of different exploration. And sometimes that's wonderful, but we're living in an unprecedented era, the era of the internet, where people can access all sorts of things that they couldn't get a hold of in times past. And that's made even more complicated by the era of social networking, which allows people to find stuff and then post it and share it with the rest of their friends and world and, in a way, connect them to what they are connecting to. Now, I'm going to tell you a story. I hope you can enjoy this one. But one of the people who we knew when we were first believers, they had an odd experience when they first became believers. They were hippies. And they were living in the mountains in the wilderness area, far away from the rest of civilization, because that was their lifestyle. And they loved to smoke pot, get high, and take naked saunas together, men and women. And somehow they came to the Lord. There was a moment, one of them, a guy who was very dear to us, was living in a teepee without electricity, without anything, and the weather got really cold, and the teepee froze, and it broke, and so his house was gone, and so he had to move, you know, to something else. Well, these people, these hippies, you know, living outside of mainstream culture, getting high, taking naked saunas together, are now continuing in their habits and they're worshiping the Lord and they're getting high and leading other people to the Lord. And it shouldn't work like that. But there was a moment when they were continuing in this. Can you see? It's hard to imagine, isn't it? But they were serious tokers. And I cannot explain, maybe I don't remember ever hearing, but at some moment, I guess when they were high, they thought, maybe we shouldn't do this. Something came over them and they realized it's not a good idea to be stoned and trying to lead people to the Lord. And not to be stoned and invite them to a naked sauna together for worship. That's not a good idea. Now, this sounds ridiculous, right? I'm telling you this because when people come to the Lord, the condition that they're in and the fellowship that they have affects what they think is normal, at least for a while. So all these people, they're getting high, they're getting naked, they're worshiping, they're reading the Bible, and they think, because everyone around them is doing this, because they're living in the wilderness, and the only people around them are just them and their friends, you know, their little commune. And then it hits them. This is not normal. And so they turned away from all of that. They had to turn away from their fellowship because some of them saw this before others did. And can you imagine saying, you know, we got to stop smoking dope. And the others say, but that's how we met the Lord. We got to stop these mixed naked saunas. Why? You know, God made us like this. Can you understand the reinforcement that you get by the circle that you're in? And some of you can understand this. How many of you can? I'm not going to ask you. Don't raise your hand. We're in such a congregation, all the hands can go up. Yeah, I get it. Not because your details were the same. Not all of you because your details were the same. It's important to come to grips with stuff like this. Because when people come to the Lord, they come as they are and they come with who they come. And there's a reinforcing circle that can build this up. So what I've noticed is in this social networking age, people are pulling from all kinds of sources that are not reliable. They're in fact dangerous. They're liking them, sharing them, posting them, passing them on to their friends because they see sometimes in those sources something that's like what Yeshua said or like what's in the scriptures. It may even be what the scriptures say. But because it's from a dangerous source, I want to warn you, you shouldn't do it. All of the Hasidic movement is committed to several things. One of them is this, Kabbalah, the sources of Zohar, Lurianic text. And you might say, well, I don't know what that's all about. Good. But you might say, well, that's not the stuff I go for. Or you might say, yeah, but I'm in a Messianic Hasidic group. And I'd say, light another joint. Because it's the same. You see the comparison? Because it's the same kind of thing. Do you get it? Do you get it? And I'm trying to be funny about very serious things because I want your defenses down. I don't want you to be pushing away from these very serious issues so that you can understand them. The Hasidic movement, the various forms of orthodoxy as well, conservative Judaism, Reform Judaism, all forms of Judaism that are not essentially Messianic Judaism, what unites them is that they do not accept that Yeshua is the Messiah and that he is Adonai. And what unites them as well is that they do not accept the authority of the New Covenant scriptures, but they accept the authority of things that are not the scriptures, and thus Talmud, and the creation, the mythological creation of something that doesn't actually exist, which is oral Torah. It doesn't exist because it's not Torah, because Torah was given in written form to us and had already been settled long before oral Torah was ever created. And these movements have different forms and different shapes, and some of them have tremendous spiritual riches, but what they do not have is the most important, and that is they do not have the revelation of Messiah Yeshua. And in fact, what can make some of them dangerous is that they have a revelation of another Messiah. And they welcome, encourage, and even require of their followers, as do all Hasidic movements, require that they learn Kabbalah. And they understand the danger of it, and so they say you've got to be at a certain level before you learn this or that. But by recognizing the danger, they are recognizing danger. Now, you need to recognize the danger. And you might say, you know, I only share the stuff that I like. Yeah, but you are recommending to your friends that they dabble in all the stuff when you share. I want you to understand how Facebook works, how Twitter works. When you post something from a source, your friends are seeing it, and they're understanding, oh, you like that source and this thing. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, you could say in defense of yourself, yeah, but I'm only posting the things that I think are good and that are like what Yeshua said or even what Yeshua said. But would you post on your Facebook something from a black witchcraft group that quoted something that also was like what Yeshua said? Do you think that would be a good idea, to connect your friends with that? Do you see that if you are connecting in this day and age, you are recommending and referring, whether you know it or not? That's why I try to be very cautious. And you know, I'm not narrow-minded, and I have broad experience. And also, I'm exposed to a lot of things. I know what you're posting. Some of you even forget I'm one of your friends on Facebook. Or you might go home and say, I'm unfriending Rabbi David, you know. And you don't know that I can follow you anyway. And you may not know that your friend, who's still your friend, that because they're my friend, I'm seeing some of your stuff. So just be, you know, fair warning. But we should all know this. When what you share on social networks is not private. How many of you have ever sent a private email to someone and it got out? The rest of you don't even know what your friends are doing with your private stuff. There is no privacy in the digital world like this. Don't fool yourself. It's important to understand what you're doing and what you mean by it and what you're connecting people to. So in these weeks ahead, we'll look at some things that could be useful to you. Now, Sandy and I lived in Budapest for a while, and we On one Yom Kippur, we went to a modern Orthodox synagogue in Budapest. And the president of the synagogue came up to me and introduced himself, asked me my Hebrew name, David ben Beryl HaLevi. And he said, oh, great, we need a Levi for the Aliyah. Will you do that? And he's speaking to me in English, and I'm speaking to him in English. And I asked him some question about, you know, why did he approach me? And he said, well, I knew you weren't from here. You see, I was wearing at that time a tallit that had burgundy-colored, sort of wine-colored bands, plus black. And nobody in that synagogue wore that color. They wore blue, or they wore black stripes. Yeah. And I had a... Yeah. So, you know, I had a tallit that was smaller than some of theirs. But it was the color that gave me away. And so the guy's talking to me later in the service and says, so what brings you to Budapest? And I said, well, I'm here working in a Messianic Jewish synagogue. Messianic Jewish, you know. He says, oh, good, good. And he goes away, and I'm thinking about this. And so I go back to him. I say, do you know what Messianic Jewish means? And he said, no. And so I explained to him, and he went, oh. And I said, I'm not trying to do anything, you know, that would create awkwardness for you. Or, you know, so even though as a Levite, I have the right to assert that I should be called up for the Levitical reading. I said, you don't have to call me up. I don't want to create any problem in the synagogue. And he said, it won't be a problem because they don't know who you are. It was that simple. My tallit gave me away. Now, what you might not know is if you live in Israel, your kippah gives you away. The kind of kippah you wear tells what religious movement you're a part of and what political positions you're taking. Oh, yeah. So, for instance, if you wear a kippah like I'm wearing right now, which is crocheted, then you are definitely not Hasidic. In fact, in Israel, some of the leading rabbis of the ultra-Orthodox have said of Israeli Orthodox Jews who wear kippot like I wear, they're not Jews. They can't be called up to Torah. They're apostates. Depending on the kind of kippah you wear, you're saying what movement you're a part of and what you're not a part of. Depending on some of the colors, even the size, if you wear a big black kippah, it means one thing. If you wear a small black kippah, it means another thing. It also communicates whether you think Arabs should be expelled from the land of Israel, whether you think a two-state solution is possible, and even whether you think Zionism is a work of the devil. Because there are orthodoxies who think that the state of Israel is an imposter and a pretender because it wasn't started by the sovereign work of God through Messiah. They live in Israel. They don't serve in the army. They want the defenses. You know, a lot of inconsistencies. And you might not know that because you put on that kippah, you're communicating all of this. I saw a picture in a Jewish magazine of a Messianic Jewish worship service, and there was one picture where there are all these people with their hands lifted up worshiping, you know, very familiar for many of us. And then there was this other picture. And there were all these people, and they were worshiping like this. And when you looked at the picture, you know what it looked like? Sig Heil. So I can tell you this, you know, there are a lot of different ways that people behave here, but if I start seeing a bunch of this, I'll say, you know, didn't we talk about that? Because you have to know what you're doing and how it's understood. Now, you might not get it depending on what your Jewish experience has been and is. And people may not be telling you all of this in your circles. But I think it's important to understand. And if you were thinking about sports, it would make perfect sense. If you are a Gators fan and you're sitting on the wrong side at the stadium, it's going to get uncomfortable, right? In fact, if you're rooting for the wrong team and you're on the wrong side, there are people who will impolitely simply drown you out and make you feel unwelcome. However, if you go to Europe and you're wearing the jersey of your team and you're sitting on the side of the other team, it's not polite. They just beat you up. Because you are for them. So it's important to understand what your clothing means, what your behavior means. And it may not always be clear to you. I grew up in a synagogue where we did certain things certain ways. And some of them we do here, some of them we don't. But I see sometimes that people have been on the internet and they like learn something new and they don't even know where it came from. And to be honest, I should have brought this up earlier. But I think now it's not too late, but it's necessary because of the rise of social networking and the way things spread. And also because we don't want to be incoherent as a congregation. We want to be diverse, we want to be clear, but we want it to be clear also what we are not. And I want to encourage you to make your choices wisely and to learn and to come over the next few weeks as we're studying together. We're going to learn some of the things that were Yeshua's customs that went against other customs that were Jewish. Some of the customs that he and the apostles had that were 100% similar or identical to other Jewish customs. We'll look at those examples, and we'll also look at some of the warnings that he gives about what to do and what not to do when you go second or third hand or when you embrace Talmudic customs that may be at odds with Torah teaching. And when you embrace external things that could actually substitute for very important internal things. So that's what's ahead. I think it's going to be interesting. And I want to encourage you to learn well. I do believe we may punch out a few sacred cows. We may say some things that strike you the wrong way. And I hope that you'll still search the scriptures to see what's true. And not be looking for other sources to see what's true. Because it will help you understand what does it mean to be in a messianic synagogue versus another kind of synagogue. So with that in mind, let's close. And I want to invite you right after we leave here to join us in the Flex Room for a nice oneg in honor of April's bat mitzvah. And the Shalom Center is being upgraded right now. New carpet, new furniture is in transit, and we'll be here shortly. And when we return there, it's going to be really exciting and wonderful. But right now, we're in the Flex Room. So let's close with Aaron's blessing. Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmarecha. Ya'er Adonai p'navei lecha v'ichunecha. Yisa Adonai p'navei lecha. Vayasemlecha shalom. The Lord bless you. The Lord keep watch over you. The Lord protect you. The Lord cause the light of his face to shine upon you. The Lord be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his face to you in the name of Yeshua. Yeshua, the Prince of Peace. Amen. Shabbat shalom.